work takes up most of your time. That's why you should use Stamps.com to save time with your mailing and shipping. Stamps.com will simplify your postage needs and add valuable time back into your workday, so you have flexibility to focus on more important things. Stamps.com can handle your mailing and shipping needs with rates up to 88% off UPS and USPS. Send invoices, checks, certified mail, packages, and anything else you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. If you sell online, connecting with every major marketplace and shopping cart is easy. Plus, you can schedule package pickups through their dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with Stamps.com's Rate Advisor. Add more flexibility to your workday with Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com/program to sign up for a special offer. No contract, cancel anytime. That's Stamps.com/program.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to 2025 and to the Time of Monsters podcast. So for the new year, I'm very happy to welcome on two friends of the podcast who listeners will be very familiar with. David Cleon, who I can announce is going to be starting up a column in The Nation and writes for the magazine and many other places, and is also working on a new book on the history of neoconservatism. And Matt Duss, the foreign policy expert, former advisor to Bernie Sanders, and now at the Center for International Policy. And I'm have these two fine gentlemen on to talk about an article about foreign policy, but perhaps also a window into the madness of a certain type of very powerful mindset in America. The article is in the Tablet magazine. It's by David Samuels, and it is called Rapid Onset Political Enlightenment. When talking about the article, I want to like maybe emphasize that the although it's a very weird and strange article, a lot of the ideas behind it are one strand of the kind of foreign policy elite in America, and a very powerful strand in terms of the Trump administration, shares in this thinking. So it's something that we kind of have to not just mock, although we will mock it, but also engage with it seriously. So maybe we can start off with David. Welcome to the podcast for the new year. And do you want to maybe just describe what this article is all about?
Happy New Year to you both, and thanks for having me as always, G. So this article, Rapid Onset Political Enlightenment, which dropped in the last few weeks, and has this like kind of amazing art at the top that looks like a mid-20th century novel. It's subtitled How Barack Obama Built an Omnipotent Thought Machine and How It Was Destroyed. And I think that pretty well summarizes the article. David Samuels' thesis is that Barack Obama and his inner circle, particularly David Axelrod and Ben Rhodes, constructed a sort of like 21st century propaganda machine using the power of the tech industry that totally captured America beginning in 2008 and has been in continuous control of everything until this year, 2024, when Donald Trump's second election victory finally defeated it. That means that Barack Obama was secretly running the country through the first Trump term and also through Biden's term. And this piece, which is very, very long, as has been Samuel's wont lately, basically is an alternate history of the last 16 years. And although it seem and major voices on the right have been sharing it, including people like Ted Cruz. I think it clearly aligns with a lot of conservative thinking right now, as in the Trump Musk era. And it is to anyone of a left or liberal persuasion, it seems like the ravings of a lunatic, but the ravings of a very smart lunatic and a compelling writer who at one time was a prestigious figure in our world. And I think as you read through it, you get a kind of, like, of all the conspiratorial accounts of recent history I've read, it's the one I find most, I don't want to say persuasive because there are holes all through it, but I can see the very weird way his mind got him to this point. And I can almost see the attraction of believing this is what's really happened over the last 16 years.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that a lot of the arguments are not novel to David Samuels. They resonate with a lot of what people on the right, and I would even say some centrists, have sort of thought about the sort of political turmoil of the last few decades. Some of the tendencies in the article are the sort of classic conspiratorial thinking of, you have a secret puppet master, you have media manipulation, elite manipulation, and then you have the sort of powerless people who are taken over by this. I think, Matt, you have kind of some thoughts about this, the way in which it follows a sort of pattern of classic conspiracy thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I have a few interesting ways of entry into this. First off, having been part of the, so-called echo chamber, back when I was at Center for American Progress and later the Foundation for Middle East Peace, writing in support of diplomacy with Iran first and then support of the JCPOA. And that was, of course, that article that Samuels did about Ben Rhodes that introduced that term that Rhodes himself used. Is kind of like a foundational, I mean, that's the key to, and Samuels writes this himself in the piece, of that's the key to understanding the change that Obama hath wrought on our politics. And then also for a period of time before he wrote that article, I actually wrote for Tablet a few times with Samuels as my editor, including about Iran diplomacy and the agreement. But I think just focusing on, what Samuel says at the very beginning, I mean, the entire premise of his argument is based on what I can only call a conspiratorial view of what the Iran deal actually was. And this is now, I remember when I think it was a piece by Michael Duran or someone who was like, the secret goal of Obama's Iran nuclear agreement is essentially to help establish Iran as a regional hegemon in the Middle East. So that the U.S. can eventually withdraw. Now, that is just completely ridiculous. I think what Duran did and what others have done since then was to kind of point to some comments that Obama had made over the years, the idea being we're going to get this nuclear agreement, and then it could potentially lead to ongoing talks with Iran such that we can find some way to build a regional kind of architecture in which Iran plays a role. I mean, I think that's a good goal. Iran's not going anywhere. We want a regional architecture, a set of relationships where people are talking and not fighting. And yet you had this whole kind of crew of folks who now, as Samuels does, simply take it as their kind of starting point, that this was the secret goal of the Iran nuclear agreement. And this is why Obama had to use, these special mind tricks, using these new tools of social media and everything to sell this deal. But again, as someone who was involved in that, first I want to say, all this stuff about the echo chamber kind of annoyed me, as it annoyed a lot of folks who were part of that, kind of coalition, because the Obama administration didn't build the echo chamber. We did. There were groups who had been working in support of Iran diplomacy going back to the George W. Bush administration. And we were very, very happy that Senator Barack Obama, as a candidate, really seemed to want to do this, really, proposed and then defended diplomacy with Iran. As people, I think, should remember, back during the 2008 primary, you know, he proposed, listen, we got to sit down and talk with Iran. And Hillary Clinton attacked him for it, and others attacked him for it, the so-called kind of foreign policy serious people. But he quite admirably stood up and refused, you know, he refused to back down. And, you know, it took him a while. It took him into his second, you know, administration, the second term, before he got really, really serious about diplomacy with Iran. But he had a lot of support. I mean, there's a reason why the overwhelming majority of actual nonproliferation experts and regional experts supported the JCPOA. It wasn't because of, you know, a Kenyan anti-colonialist mind trick. It was because it was, you know, a good nonproliferation agreement. And Samuel simply cannot countenance that, which is part of what, you know, gives rise to, well, there must be this alternate explanation, which is what, you know, gives rise to the article.
Yeah, I want to talk a little more about that article, the original one, which was published in the New York Times in 2016, I think, if not 2015, which was pitched as a profile of Ben Rhodes. And having read Ben Rhodes's memoir, which is actually pretty good, the first campaign memoir, it's worth reading. He talks about this piece, and he says something very telling about why he agreed to do it. I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but he basically says, you know, I didn't really know David Samuels, but he had written for the kinds of places I like to read, like The Atlantic or The New Republic, which would have been the, you know, Parrot's Weasel Tear era New Republic that we've talked about a lot. And so I figured, okay, well, sure, he wants to write a, you know, kind of a literary profile of me for at the end of the Obama era for the New York Times. You know, of course, I'd say yes. And he's writing this knowing that it was a mistake in hindsight. So the profile in question, which got a lot of attention, you know, he had a lot of access. He followed Rhodes around. He kind of built him up into this figure, you know, who went to like fancy Upper East Side private schools, and he wanted to be a novelist in the tradition of Don DeLillo, but then instead he went into the foreign policy world, and he had this mind meld with Barack Obama and ended up becoming his top foreign policy advisor, and yada yada yada, he's selling the Iran deal. And you know, all of those things are basically, you know, as bare facts about Ben Rhodes, true and interesting. And reading them as someone who sympathized with the Iran deal, I found myself thinking, oh, this Ben Rhodes guy, he seems kind of cool. But Samuels presents the piece. I mean, since then, I've spoken to Ben Rhodes, and Matt, I know you know Ben, maybe you do too, Jeet. And, you know, he's a very smart guy, but like, he's not like a hypnotist who controls like the way everyone in Washington thinks. I mean, in the telling that David Samuels gives, Rhodes has like the gifts of a would-be great novelist, which is a set of gifts that Samuels admires. You know, he's a literary guy himself. And he used those in some like, you know, totally unprecedented fashion to like manipulate everyone in DC media and control them and sell them on something that to Samuels is self-evidently absurd, which is that the US should be doing diplomacy with Iran. And because Samuels cannot for the life of him accept that a reasonable person might think that's a good idea, even if they're wrong, they might think it's, you know, worth trying. He thinks the only way this could happen is if Ben Rhodes is this once in a lifetime literary genius with the power to reshape minds. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, from the beginning is absurd, but then, and also really weird when you think about like the history of Washington. I mean, you know, we all studied the neocons. I'm studying them now. And they were often talked about in very conspiratorial terms as this, you know, secretive Jew-coded cabal that brainwashed Washington into fighting wars for Israel or whatever. And the truth is a lot more banal than that. I mean, in some ways, it's a lot more interesting and nuanced than that. But, you know, the truth is they, like Ben Rhodes, like you, Matt, like any number of, like in a different vein, sorry to put you all in the same breath, but like someone like Stephen Miller, you know, there are these guys who get fixated on particular policy goals and sort of figure out how to work the system. But it's very important when they do so that they find a politician, ideally a presidential candidate, who their ideas make sense to, and who their ideas seem to kind of align with the broader political currents behind that person. You know, Obama was coming off of a lot of public exhaustion with the war on terror, yeah, and the, you know, regrets about the Iraq war. And all of that, I think, was leveraged into this moment to make, you know, a not particularly generous deal with Iran, but to pivot U.S. foreign policy a little bit.
And
to Samuels, this is just so insane from the sort of increasingly right-wing Zionist fever swamps that Tablet is involved in, that he can't believe it. And what's fascinating about this new article is how over the subsequent 8 years, not only does Samuels completely stand by his outlandish thesis that was published in the New York Times, but layered on top of it is a bunch of other stuff that have been Tablet fixations, including, to think of just the most obvious ones, you know, Tablet has become aggressively anti-woke and basically thinks wokeness is, you know, a mind virus. I mean, they have the same perspective as Elon Musk or Curtis Yarvin on this. And that, you know, because the public rejects, let's say, using the term Latinx, or rejects using they, them pronouns, or some large part of the public does, it must mean that anyone who does think that's a good idea has been brainwashed. This is also mixed up with critiques of Silicon Valley algorithms, which again, you know, like, yes, Silicon Valley does deliberately make its social media platforms addictive and has used them to gin up all kinds of outrage. But it's fascinating to me how they think that, you know, Tumblr style wokeness that maybe peaked on Twitter, 8 to 10 years ago, that was manipulation by Barack Obama directed woke elites. Whereas, you know, the insane right wing MAGA culture that sprung up and now controls the country is like the authentic populist view of the American people.
Right.
Just to throw in the mix, Russiagate. Tablet has been running Lee Smith, you know, who eventually wrote a whole book that basically posits Russiagate as a kind of like CIA orchestrated woke liberal conspiracy to bring down the blameless Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure we can all agree there were excesses in how the mainstream media covered Russiagate, and that the Steele dossier was junk. Mm-hmm. And depending on your definition of collusion, you can make different arguments for whether or not Trump actually colluded with the Russians. But it is very annoying that after all this time and all the sort of, you know, sand that's been kicked in the gears, like there was, according to the Mueller report, a very large Russian interference campaign to favor Donald Trump in the 2016 election. I mean, this shouldn't really be up for debate anymore. The only real debate is, you know, was Donald Trump just kind of nodding along with it happily? We're pretty sure he didn't call up Vladimir Putin and say, like, yes, I'm part of your nefarious scheme. So the debate is basically, ethically, is it a problem to you that Donald Trump seemed to welcome this interference on his behalf without directly coordinating it? And the Tablet view, the David Samuels view, and increasingly the right view, but also the view of a swath of the left, is that the entire thing was completely made up.
Yeah.
There's nothing to it at all. And in order to believe otherwise, again, you'd have to be brainwashed by Barack Obama's thought machine.
Well, I think there's a bit of, you know, as with most conspiracies, there is a kernel of truth,
right?
So that's the claim he is making about, you know, Russiagate. But at the same time, one can also, you know, he is engaged in that same sort of thing with the broader claim he is making about Obama. It is true, actually, that Obama retains a considerable amount of influence in the Democratic Party. It is not a surprise for a relatively young former president to continue to have this kind of influence. Look
who, at Bill who Clinton. who was elected twice and left office popular.
That's exactly right.
But
there's like two points I'd make here. One is going back to, you know, the kind of impact of these influence campaigns. You use the example of the Iraq War, which, you know, I found this passage really wild, where Samuels mentions the Iraq War. He's like, you know, looking at what Barack Obama was able to do for around the Iran deal, the danger is that future presidents could do things like the Iraq War. I mean, really, yes, imagine that. Imagine an administration that was really committed to disinformation and misinforming the public to gin up support for a horrible policy.
If I were one of the top editors at a publication that publishes Judith Miller as its theater critic, I would maybe think a little bit about what I'm saying here about the nefarious influence of elites with dumb ideas.
But the second and I think bigger point about the article is this is what really just... you know, baffles me is he's essentially, you know, proposing that it is Obama who is the anti-system figure.
Yeah. Right.
And Trump is the pro-system savior who has now returned.
Well, I might nuance that. I think he sees the system and the public is at odds. I think Trump is the champion of the public in his mind and what like Americans actually want. And Obama is the champion of the elite system.
Maybe that's a bit more charitable.
I think I'm actually more with Matt on this one, because if you actually look at the article, he's saying Obama had subverted like these gatekeepers and ways of getting at the truth and had, you know, brought in some totally alien way of thinking.
Yeah,
it is a weird way of recasting Trump as the pro-establishment figure, and that America has somehow been like secretly controlled for 20 years by this deeply subversive secret puppet king.
And this is where it goes back to, I think, this strain of like, you know, just frankly, bigoted thinking among the kind of whatever you want to call them, the Peretzian liberal, kind of this sense that Barack Obama is not fully American.
There is something
suspect about him. And again, this in other contexts, this is a very familiar form of bigotry. When you're basically the argument is that Barack Obama doesn't understand American exceptionalism. He's basically this rootless cosmopolitan who has been very skillfully pulling the strings. That's all very familiar in other contexts. And I've seen it. This goes back to very early on when Obama announced for the presidency in 2008. These whisper campaigns began immediately. Sometimes they were more overt. Sometimes they were a bit more coded. But it was an ongoing argument that people made about Obama. And I think we can see it clearly in this piece.
Yeah. And not just coming from the right as well. I mean, like one of the progenitors of all this was Hillary Clinton advisor Mark Penn, who very specifically had a whisper campaign against Obama as an American. I mean, I would even go a bit further. Like, it is a kind of way in which this is the classic anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, except Obama is the Jew. He is the Jewish puppet master. He's the rootless cosmopolitan who has no real allegiance to the country, who is secretly using his power over the media and mind control powers to manipulate and using as a battering ram for his political movement the unwashed masses, particularly people of color, to subvert the traditional order. Now, we're sort of familiar with this if it's applied to someone like George Soros. Maybe we can see the sort of, you know, anti-Semitic contours of that. But it's a curious thing that instead Obama is the secret Jew. And in some ways, I think you think about why someone like Samuels and the Peretzian people are attracted to this is, in so I almost have a psychological explanation. Like, they are familiar with like sort of the anti-Semitic view, and they have somehow projected it onto their like enemy to say, you know, we're not the because it is true that there is a type of criticism.
Right.
Of
because if I'm attacking someone else of being a bad American, I'm obviously the good American.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Well, and here's where I want to do a little capsule history of David Samuels, because I think and of Tablet, because I think it is really fascinating. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Samuels is a Gen Xer. He came up in 80s parrots era TNR. His most famous piece from that era, Witch Parrots, in his memoir that Jeet and I have both reviewed and discussed here, you know, recalls fondly as basically a cover story about how the real audience for rap, which was exploding in popularity in the 80s, was white suburban teens. And as with all subsequent Samuel's work, it's a mix of a very provocative kind of offensive point. And also, yeah, there is some truth to that. Like, of course, white suburban teens were a major constituency. And not just that they were as a business fact, but he was saying essentially that the sort of like fantasy image of the ghetto and gangster violence and sexual fantasies and so on that you know were commodified by rap were basically
means, everything people wrote about Elvis back in the 50s.
Yeah. But of course,
about jazz. I mean, but
with Elvis and jazz too, it's like there was a. I mean, what's weird is that I think that David Samuels actually likes rap in spite of all that. I mean, he's an interesting figure for sure. Yeah. But in any case, flash forward some years, he's a very acclaimed journalist. He's written for all the established places. In the I guess in the very early Obama years, Tablet launches out of this project called Nextbook. The person who started it is a woman named Alana Newhouse, who hired Samuels, and eventually Samuels left his wife, Virginia Heffernan, for Newhouse. So now they're a married couple and the kind of first family of Tablet. But Tablet launched in the in the early Obama era, I believe. And it was supposed to be a kind of like, you know, a kind of, this was like peak blogosphere, peak you could actually write and get paid for writing on the internet, time we're all nostalgic for. And Tablet was supposed to be an explicitly Jewish online journal with a kind of, you know, punchier sensibility, but it was supposed to be a little more highbrow than like Heeb, which was another attempt at that or Juicy that didn't last as well as Tablet did. And I always, at the time, I had a good friend who was writing for it, who's still my good friend, Mark Tracy, and who was doing a blog for it called The Scroll. And Mark is, you know, a left liberal basically. And I thought, well, if, you know, Mark is the most frequent writer for Tablet, they've got to be at least pretty inclusive and liberal enough. Over time, and since Mark left for various other jobs, eventually the New York Times, Tablet has steadily over the last decade or so moved further and further right until today, when it publishes people who I think can reasonably be called hate figures, like Richard Hanania or Wesley Yang, a formerly respectable writer who's entire mind, body, and soul is consumed with virulent transphobia now. Samuels has gotten more and more conspiratorial, as has Newhouse as time has gone on. Samuels founded another site recently with Walter Kern, a formerly respectable novelist. The movie, the George Clooney movie Up in the Air, was based on a book of his. And Kern has kind of gone off the deep end too and become a Trumper. A measure of how much Kern has lost the plot is that our beloved Thomas Chatterton Williams flew to his home in Montana to do a profile of him for The Atlantic last year, the year before. And I could tell that Thomas Chatterton Williams went in feeling sympathetic to Kern, you know, like, oh, he's, you know, an acclaimed, respected writer. He used to have a column at the New Republic. Now he's been sort of right curious and anti-woke. And I think Chatterton Williams could relate to all that. And by the end of the piece, he's like, oh, this guy's really crazy now, isn't he? Like, he's gone way outside the you know, Atlantic centrist consensus. Like, this guy is crazy. And so Kern and Samuels are close, and they've started a site which is all about, it's called like Country Road or something. It's basically like County Highway. Thank you. That's the actual name. I was so close. It isn't a big deal, but I mention it because essentially, you know, Kern lives in Montana, and I think Samuels must live upstate or somewhere a lot of the time. He used to live in Brooklyn. And I think, and Samuels frequently writes in his own pieces or inserts into the pieces he's editing for Tablet diatribes against like the Ivies. He went to an Ivy, Park Slope. And that whole culture, right, against the culture of liberalism right now. So I think he and Kern have sort of like embraced rural America and sort of asserted their rural Americanness
the
true spirit of the Volk, while clearing hundreds of thousands of dollars from last I checked, which was a few years ago, Tablet's funding overwhelmingly came from Mem Bernstein, who is the widow of a key founder of the right-wing Tikva Fund, which funds all kind of right-wing pro-Israel activity. And there was like a public disclosure that I think between them, Alana Newhouse and David Samuels were collecting something like $650,000 a year from this website whose budget is, you know, a few million dollars. It is tempting to think like what happened here. They were bought by, you know, a very deep-pocketed right-wing Zionist donor, and the rest is history. But following them closely over the last decade, as I have, I think something much weirder than that is also going on, not inconsistent with that.
I mean, there's a couple of strands here I wanted to maybe like tie together. The fact that these are people coming from the respectable center wing, like, you know, as you said, Ben Rhodes thought, you know, like, oh, I'll talk to David Samuels. He writes for the New York Times Magazine. He had written for Harper's. And a lot of these characters, and I think that there's a mistaken view, which I trace back to Richard Hofstadter, that conspiracy theories are a fringe phenomena and are like coming out of marginalized people in society are the ones that are attracted to conspiracy theories. This is the sort of the Hofstadter view. And I've always insisted, and other historians that I've learned from have insisted, that no, there's actually been a very powerful strain of conspiratorialism that has come from the powerful. That is, in fact, the very powerful people in the elite who have the most to lose and who are often very fearful of the world outside. So, you know, like traditional American anti-Semitism was not so much coming from the populist farmers that Hofstadter blamed. It was coming from people in Wall Street and the sort of, you know, WASP elite. They were the ones who wanted to, you know, were worried about Jewish radicals destroying America. They're the ones who set up the quotas.
And now the Jews are the new WASPs and the woke are the new Jew. The woke, diverse, new elites are the new Jews.
Like J. Edgar Hoover or Richard Nixon, like these are the sort of bastions of American conspiracy theory who, like, you know, were the ones who promulgated ideas of, you know, like subversive and communists. And so if you have like people in the elite who have a very fearful view and are inclined to see foreign threats of, like, you know, Iranian subversion, or on the liberal side, actually, like, you know, some of the Russiagate stuff coming from the same centrist elite who think that everything is blamed on Putin, that these are the people, it's the centrist elites are just as likely to go like wild on conspiracy theories as, you know, people like out in the boondocks who suddenly go into QAnon. There is a tradition of centrist attraction towards conspiracy theories, and which is how I would place a lot of these figures.
There's also a relationship between the two, I think, because one thing that you can do if you have the sort of Harvard and Park Slope credentials or whatever equivalent, is you can reach a wider audience outside those precincts while credibly claiming that you know what those places are really like, because you do, through whatever personal distortion you do, you knew these people. So something that I see a lot with people who come out of this world is they'll often post their credentials. And actually, I can't believe I've gone this long without mentioning her, but, you know, Tablet remains kind of niche. I mean, it's still very Jewish coded. Yeah. It's still for a very specific, albeit perhaps influential kind of audience. But the single most plausible claim to Tablet's influence, I think, is that Barry Weiss came up through them and remains very close with the people running it and promotes them periodically as a major influence on their thinking. And Barry Weiss, much as people would like to pretend otherwise, is massively influential now. Yeah. She has the Free Press was recently, perhaps absurdly, but whatever, valued at like $100 million. She has a direct line to people like Mark Andreessen, Peter Thiel, and Elon Musk, who basically run the country right now. She's built up a huge staff. She's plugged into all these celebrity and donor circles. And her wife, Nellie Bowles, you know, comes from generational wealth. And I follow their activities very closely, too. And people at the Free Press, including Barry and Nellie, are constantly pointing to, like, we worked at the New York Times. We went to Columbia. We did, like, it's actually very important for them to understand to their audience, that apparently includes a million paid subscribers now, that they, you know, completely understand this world of the liberal elite, that they were a part of it, they were accepted in it, they succeeded on its terms, and they are declaring knowledgeably that it is a conspiracy against the public, basically.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It has that sort of native informer aspect, which has always been a big part of what I would say is traditional neoconservatism. That's also like Podhertz's claim, you know?
Absolutely.
I went to Columbia, I was a New York intellectual, I know what these people are like, and they're trying to destroy America.
1,000%.
And then Peretz, you know, very similar. I'm a Harvard guy. I know what the elites are, and they're bad. So it's an interesting sort of insider-outsider game where you claim both insider credentials and outsider critique. The other aspect I want to bring up is to tie up the threads together, which you have both mentioned, is, you know, like this sort of like element of truth aspect to this, because I do think that a lot of this thinking comes from the fact that, you know, there is an American establishment. There are like these elites. Sometimes these elites, especially, you know, over the last few decades, have screwed up in massive ways, you know, in terms of the Iraq war and the financial meltdown. And so there's like an appetite for suppression. And, you know, like, you know, while I don't think like Obama is the secret puppet master that ruled the Biden administration, you know, like Obama's role in helping Biden get the nomination in 2020 is something, you know, like I was not very happy with that.
I can speak about and mention my own credentials, having experienced the impact of Obama's personal influence in a pretty, you know, unique way. And yet I'm not buying this whole argument.
Well, see, the one thing I want to mention for the article, just to like underscore all the absurdity, is he talks about these thought viruses and catchphrases that the Obama network has spread out, like, you know, defend the police, which, you know, the Democrats on a national level were never embraced, structural racism, which is just like a term of analysis. He also says, stop the genocide in Gaza. So basically what you're
saying
because is...
Because if you see these images of Palestinian children on your phone all day, you know, being destroyed by American missiles, you know, any reasonable person would think that's justifiable. Only someone who's been brainwashed.
But also, what is the logic that you're arguing here, that the Obama is secretly running the Biden administration, which is funding the mass slaughter of civilians in Gaza, but he's also putting out these thought viruses to stop the genocide in Gaza, which undermines the Democrats, right? Which, you know, arguably is a big factor in their loss in the last election. So, like, what exactly is the argument here?
And Obama, like, to his disgrace, in my view, has said next to nothing.
Yes.
About Gaza.
Yeah, but you know who has, though? Ben Rhodes and Tommy Vitor, noted Obama world inner circle advisors, have actually been admirably outspoken about it. With Obama, though, I don't want to defend it, because I don't want to defend anyone not speaking out on genocide. There are hints from both his past career and at the very margins of what he says that he thinks Biden has been too enabling of Netanyahu. The fact that two of his former advisors have been very outspoken to that effect also implies that to me. And there is this tradition, which the late Jimmy Carter, rest in peace, was like the only dissenter from in the last several decades, of presidents not criticizing the sitting president, that they...
Trump also.
Trump, of course, completely throws that out the window. Yeah. But Carter, I mean, even within the Democratic line, was the guy who would do that. And that's why they all were kind of pissed at him all the time.
But I think,
you know, with the Obama thing, it's like, There are holes if you look at this in a less, you know, galaxy brain, less conspiratorial, less honestly bad faith way. Like, you know, for instance, Obama has repeatedly over the last decade or so criticized wokeness from a kind of Atlantic centrist point of view.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's repeatedly said gently, and I mean, this is the first black president who, you know, in some ways, the very existence of his administration ushered in a lot of kind of, I guess you could say, woke triumphalism, a lot of thinking that, like, you know, we're going to be a proudly diverse multicultural nation now and leave, you know, our white supremacist past behind, which obviously turned out to be optimistic and premature. But I think Obama, you know, set off a lot of that thinking, but that's not really Obama's message. And if you go back and look at how Obama messaged during his presidency, I mean, a lot of the time he was basically playing, and recently too, he's playing kind of classic respectability politics. He understood that the way he would succeed as a black president named Barack Hussein Obama was to be very unthreatening to white people.
Well, I think the more accurate critique is that with Obama, and I would also include the Clintons in this, there's a kind of, you know, bad faith or ambiguous game of, you know, like trying to generate enough sort of, you know, sympathy on social issues and cultural issues to hold power, because I think a lot of these issues are actually popular with the Democratic Party base, but then, like, you know, disavowing them when it becomes politically inconvenient. And, like, I mean, to go back to the Bernie Sanders thing, I mean, it is the case that the big thing that elevated wokeness and identity politics, the national politics in America, was Hillary Clinton deciding that in 2016, and that this was the way to beat Bernie Sanders. And, like, if we will, you know, and using basically the identity of identity politics to try to discredit class politics, that's what did it. And if you look at it in that way, then yes, the Democratic Party elite can be criticized, but it can't be criticized as secret manipulators or masterminds. They're just, like, you know, they're political actors like the rest of us, and they've done things that have sometimes worked to short-term advantage and long-term disadvantage, or have very ambiguous results. I mean,
going back to something David was saying about, you know, where Obama was actually, you know, politically, ideologically. It's just, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier, this assumption from the very beginning that despite the actual observable reality of Obama's actual policy views, which are clearly mostly just centrist neoliberalism, the fact of the matter is, you know, he is actually a secret radical. Just by virtue of who he is.
Yeah.
This is something I found Podhoretzian also, and the parallels don't stop there, that, you know, when you read Podhoretz from, like, Breaking Ranks on right up to the present, he is constantly describing the, like, far Marxist socialist left's takeover of the culture and of everything. And all he really means is what we've called liberalism for the last 50 years. You know, all he means is, like, Al Gore, you know, and Barack Obama, like the people that we actually think of as, like, the intellectual left or the cultural left are, I mean, to the extent he cares about them at all, he thinks, like, that's who people like Barack Obama take their cues from. And that's what they really think. And anyone who actually, you know, exists in these left circles, we understand exactly how marginal we are. I mean, I don't want to say we have zero influence. We clearly had a little bit of influence on the Biden administration. Now, as we've previously discussed, Matt Iglesias, we're, you know, being scapegoated for that. But you know, even Matt Iglesias admits what you just said about how wokeness was basically cynically deployed by Hillary to shut out Bernie. And, you know, it seems so bizarre to, like, look at the actual record of recent Democratic administrations or the median, you know, Senate Democrat and think, oh yeah, these people are really woke. Or to look at, you know, what are the major liberal institutions like? Yeah. You know, in journalism, places like The Atlantic or The New York Times, you know, which publish anti-woke op-eds, like, daily, you know? I mean, it's like, I have many criticisms of them, but the idea that, like, that's the far-left establishment, you know, that mind controls this country is just so baffling to me. I mean, because they give woke points of view a hearing, because they don't, you know, write them off as completely insane and beyond the pale. Like, I just, what?
I want to just return to something Matt had said, because I think it's worth underscoring, which is that the idea that Obama is uniquely radical, despite his record, race is basically based just on his race and his race alone. It is the idea, and that's true of a lot of the criticism of wokeness, of where you get these university presidents who are attacked as being woke, and it's just because they're a woman or they're, like, a black woman. It is this idea that just the very presence of people of color in these elite institutions is itself proof of a dangerous radicalism. I mean, you know, like, that is such an inherently bigoted point of view. And that is the, I think, the emotional resonance or the kind of, you know, the subtext of a lot of this kind of thinking. And I don't think we should like pussyfoot around like what exactly these the people are saying. I mean, it is, you know, someone like Dinesh D'Souza is more frank of saying, you know, Kenyan mindset or whatever. Right. But this is a Kenyan mindset.
Kenyan anti-colonial, because I think that was Gingrich or did it start?
Yeah, Newt Gingrich. Yeah. Kenyan anti, which again, like, you know, like actually the Kenyans had good reason to revolt against the British Empire, but.
They play a long game.
But to add to, even I think the Eisenhower administration supported African decolonization. But yeah, in any case,
you're right to draw the parallels to anti-Semitism, because I think, you know, back in the day when classically anti-Semitic conspiracy theories were circulating among the old Eastern WASP elite, you know, the kind of Jews who were breaking in by and large tended to be like somewhere on the, like, I mean, if they weren't center-right German Jews like Henry Kissinger or whatever, they were maybe fellow travelers like Oppenheimer, who like knew some leftists, or, you know, people who like had labor connections. But there was just this assumption like, oh, you're Jewish, you know some leftists, you've maybe read some Marx before, like you must be a radical subversive, when the truth is, you know, the people they were freaking out about were the people who would become the new establishment in this country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that is actually the worry, that this is, that there is a new establishment, which is not us, which is, you know, people of a different caste than us. And it is people from, I mean, a lot of them are the people of the old, who had sort of broken into the old establishment, like Potter and Peretz, who are suddenly worried that, oh no, there's now another changing of the guard, and that means less power for us. I mean, I actually think that is the emotional subtext for a lot of this. I mean, exactly, like people, you know, would worry about like Frankfurter and Brandeis as being advisors, and like, well, what is actually your real worry here? I think that's perhaps a good note to end it on, because I think this sort of gives us a wider context for understanding it. But again, I want to thank David and Matt for being on the podcast, and I hope this is the first of many conversations we'll have in the coming year.
It's always great to talk to you guys, and I'm excited to have more such conversations in the era of in which we're run by, as David Samuels concludes, you know, three great singular geniuses, Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and Benjamin Netanyahu, who've shattered the woke mind control machine. I'm excited to see what comes next.
All right, thanks, guys.
89% of business leaders say AI is a top priority. The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at one-third of Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. Grammarly is the right AI assistant for your team. With top-tier security credentials and 15 years of experience in responsible AI, Grammarly is how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. See why 70,000 teams trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise.
Zaxby's just out Philly'd the Philly again. The Zaxby's Chicken Philly is back with garlic aioli, sautéed peppers and onions, decadent melty cheese, and your choice of Zaxby's signature crispy chicken fingers or delicious grilled chicken. But it's only back for a limited time, so enjoy it while you can. No pressure. It's just the greatest sandwich of all time on a ticking clock. Order the Chicken Philly today. Who's got the sauce? Zaxby's.